they have one up there.
Kathleen C. from Brentwood, California.
You can put it up there. Yeah, I'm too nervous to hold it. I think you have to slide it in like...
There's got to be something.
Do you slide it in? We're technologically impaired. How do you get it on the thing?
Doesn't seem to fit in there. There you go. It's kind of slipping out. That's what he said. Sorry.
You're bad.
Just hold the damn thing.
All right, here. I'll figure it out. You're welcome. I got it. Oh my. I'm Kathleen. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. It's a little warm tonight. I was thinking we should all just go outside and sit. Oh, louder? Oh, did we turn it off? All right, I'll talk loud. I can usually talk pretty loud. I'm really honored to be here. My good friend Greg asked me to be here tonight to speak, and then he went to Norway, so he's not even here. But that's all right. I'm still honored to be here. You know, I was thinking about tonight and what I was going to talk about. I actually have never shared for 40 minutes, so we'll see how this goes. My sobriety date is October 9th, 1991. I got sober when I was 26 years old, and 2 weeks ago I turned 60. And I can't believe I'm 60, first of all. And what did I do on my 60th birthday? I decided to change the sheets on my bed, and when I was putting the king-size pillowcases back on these big king-size pillows, I threw my back out. And I thought, how apt is that, that on 60 I throw my back out putting pillowcases on? So, hence has been my sobriety, the ups and the downs. I grew up in a little town called Jeanette, Pennsylvania. That's where I was born. It was a little steel, rubber works, glass factory town. It has virtually none of that now. And it was, you know, a pretty decent childhood. My life revolved around going to the little Five and Dime and getting Swedish fish and sweet tarts, or walking the other way along the creek to Dairy Queen, because we had creeks in Pennsylvania, not creeks. You know, and it was sort of this idealistic childhood, except that all this other stuff was going on too. And I have some fond memories. I have great memories of hanging out in the Polish club with my Polish grandmother and learning how to polka as a child and having a lot of fun doing that. And I also had a raging alcoholic father at home who I was terrified of. And we never knew if he was going to come home happy or mad. And if one little thing was out of place, my older brother and I were taken to the basement and hit with the belt because it was our fault that he was angry. And so those are the things I think that shaped me more than anything else, is that I walked around on eggshells for a very long time with my dad. And I was afraid of everything. I was raised Catholic, so I thought for sure, too, that I was a sinner because I had evil thoughts about my dad and not really wanting him to be around much, and I was going to burn in hell. And I remember early memories thinking that I'm on my own, nobody's going to help me, I'm going to have to figure this out. And for whatever reason, that thought, well, it's, my husband will tell you it's still with me today. I still have a hard time asking for help. But it shaped who I became as a child, and it shaped who I was into my teen years. When I was 10, we moved from Pennsylvania to Morgantown, West Virginia, which is the home of West Virginia University and the Mountaineers. And it was a serious party school. And I never went there for school, by the way, but I seriously partied in Morgantown with all the students. And, you know, I at first was, I just got through life. You know, we moved to Morgantown, and my first addiction came to light, and that was food. We moved at the beginning of the summer, and by the time I went to school for fifth grade, I had probably gained 20 or 30 pounds because I hung out around the house or at the country club my dad was now managing, and I ate a lot of food, a lot of sugar. By the time I was 14, my oldest brother wanted to initiate me into his group of friends. And so we went out to Cheat Lake for a keg party. And I remember the red cups, and I remember floating on the inner tube in the lake, and it was wonderful. Beer was amazing. It tasted like crap, but it made me feel amazing. And there are a couple days in my drug use and drinking that I'll remember. I'll always remember that first day that I got drunk and the relief I finally felt and how happy I was. And it never occurred to me that I shouldn't do it more. I just thought, this is great. I'm going to keep doing this. And by the time I was 16, I was almost a daily drinker. I guess I started smoking some pot in there. I would drop acid. If somebody handed me acid, I'd take it. If somebody handed me speed, I would take it. Whatever happened to be around, it never occurred to me to like say, well, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. I'm just going to go ahead and do it anyway. And the relief I constantly felt from that only lasted when I was drunk or high. And when I got sober and I had to go to school the next day, and this awkwardness that I felt for so long and so out of place and so fearful would always come back. And I could only live if I didn't have to feel so afraid. And so, you know, I went through high school, and when I was 18, I moved to San Francisco. I had a cousin there, and I had gotten to go after I actually graduated high school, surprisingly, even though the assistant principal told me and my girlfriend that we would never amount to anything. I did graduate. So I'm 18 years old, and I moved to San Francisco, and in West Virginia, drinking age was 18, and now I'm in a state that the drinking age is 21. My cousin is much older than me, would occasionally allow me to have a beer, which was great. I did find the pot dealer that lived right behind the building I was living in, and so, of course, you know, I could smoke some pot here and there. And I worked at a toy store down in down by Union Square in San Francisco. That was my job. And I met a guy. And I just thought, well, this is the greatest thing ever, right? He was older, and he was probably should have been off limits to me. And I just thought it was exciting, really, really exciting to have this older man, you know, be attracted to me. He delivered toys to the toy store that I worked in. And so we went on a date, and we went by his house, and his uncle was there. And I will tell you, I do have drugs in my story. It's just everything I could get in my body, I put in my body. And he was a cocaine dealer, and I thought I was in heaven at this point. We, you know, snorted cocaine all night, we drank all night. It was absolutely amazing. And I ended up staying with that man, who turned out to be married, who had one kid at the beginning of our relationship and had another while we were still together. I spiraled really, really quickly with him. We were snorting cocaine and then freebasing cocaine, and then I spent about 5-6 years going into the projects in San Francisco to buy crack. And I was a daily drinker, but I didn't think I had a drinking problem. What I felt brought me to my knees and what helped me hit my bottom was smoking crack, because I just didn't want to do it anymore. I was absolutely miserable. I was doing things that I never imagined that I would do. I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. My family had no idea how bad my addiction was. And so, you know, it was a little bit fun occasionally. You know, I go up to the projects up on Hunter's Point, and one night, they got the kid, well, they're kids. I was waiting for my boyfriend to go buy drugs, and I'm sitting in this pickup truck, and by the way, it was my company truck, and I had the window rolled down just a little bit, and they got in, and they unlocked the door, and I thought, oh, this is not good. This is really not going to go well. I made sure I got the keys, I shoved them deep into my pocket, and I held onto the steering wheel for dear life. I knew if they got me off that steering wheel that I was probably going to die, or, you know, get beat up really badly and raped and potentially die. Who knows? And so for dear life, I hung onto that steering wheel, and they beat me up. They broke out windows in my truck, and they laughed, and it was funny to them, and I was like, this is not going to happen. They turned their backs for a moment, and I was able to shove the keys into the ignition, and it was a 3 on the tree, and to back up and take off. I did find my boyfriend later. He had also kind of been taken away and beat up by these guys, and you know, my first thought was, we got to go to the other projects across town, and we can get some more drugs there. And for whatever reason, he's like, you know, I think I'm just going to go home. And I had to make up a story of how the windows got busted out of the company truck with my boss. Like, we got almost carjacked, and, you know, I took a wrong turn. And people believed me, because I looked really innocent. You know, it's not like I'm way older now, but, you know, I still looked pretty innocent, you know, and nobody could believe the things I was doing. You know, I spent time in the Tenderloin. I gave myself away because I knew what I needed, and it worked for a little while until it stopped working. And it got to the place where I was a binge crack smoker, by the way. I was a daily drinker. There was no question. A couple bottles of wine. Oh, yeah, I was a wine connoisseur, except my wine cost like $2 a bottle. But I could then drink, you know, 2 or 3 bottles or a couple cans of beer, some, you know, vodka and cranberry. But I would start smoking crack on Thursday night. I would go to work. I worked in construction in the office. I would go to work and pray that I had like some crank or something on me. My boss was an alcoholic, so we could start drinking. It used to be 5 o'clock, and then it was 4 o'clock on Friday, and then it became 3 o'clock, which is a godsend to me. And then at the end of the workday, I would go back and I would smoke crack until the early hours of Sunday morning. My girlfriend, who's here tonight, because I am blessed with amazing people in my life now, said, I better tell the story about the mac and cheese. And I'm glad she reminded me. I didn't even remember this. So on Sunday morning, I lived on Russian Hill. And by the way, I still had an apartment because my cousin was the property manager, and she was so codependent that she made sure I had a place to live. Thank God. So I'd walk down to the corner store. I'd get a 6-pack of Miller Genuine Draft in the cans and a Stouffer's mac and cheese. I did not have a microwave, so I would have to stick that Stouffer's mac and cheese in the oven, right? It takes 60 minutes. So that would give me time to drink, you know, 3 or 4 beers. Because that first bite of mac and cheese, because I really hadn't eaten much since probably Friday, felt like the roof of my mouth was going to crack open. It hurt so bad. It was so painful to take those first couple bites. And yet I did that every weekend for like 5 years. I didn't think there was a problem with that, but for me, it felt like this was so normal to do the drugs that I was doing, to go into the most dangerous places in San Francisco to get those drugs or even to smoke those drugs and to drink every day. It was like, this is what normal people do. Everybody does what I do, right? I think for me, you know, I still had an apartment. I kind of sort of had a job, but not really. I did still have the company truck, though, because my boss was also codependent. I was lucky that way. I had some people in my life who made sure I was never really homeless, had enough food, had a car sometimes. And, you know, I'll never forget the last day, the very last day that I drank and used. So at this point, I'm 26 years old. That boyfriend that I hung out with, I had dumped him, and he was about 15 years older than me. And I decided I was going to hang out with his uncle, who was 30 years older than me, but a cocaine dealer. And this was a really good idea for me, because he wasn't as savvy as I thought he was, and I could steal drugs from him because he had a briefcase. And we are very crafty, drug addicts and alcoholics. He had a briefcase that had the combination lock, but he only locked one side of it. And so the other side had the numbers on it, right, that said these are the 3 numbers you need to put in the other side. And I figured that out pretty early on. And so when he would leave, I would steal drugs from him. And I can't even remember how long I hung out with this guy. I still had an apartment, but I was staying with him in Brisbane just because I knew he had drugs. I had been stealing from him for a few days, not sleeping, feigning sleep, pretending that I was asleep. He would take tranquilizers to fall asleep, and then I would go and cook up cocaine, and I would smoke. He was a chauffeur. He had gone off to do a job, and he came back, and I was a mess. I could no longer get high. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced that, but no matter how much you drink or how many drugs you take, I could not get high. My heart was pounding out of my chest. I had cold sweats. I had taken like a couple cold baths just to see if that could calm me down. But I kept smoking. I kept doing the cocaine. And I was pretty much out of alcohol. Alcohol at this point wasn't working. And he came home, and I was out of drugs. And I said, you know what? I need another hit. And he realized at that point that I was completely tweaking out and crazy, and he backhanded me across the face. And I have not had a drink or a drug since that day. I say that I am grateful that he smacked me across the face because I became hysterical. I ran into his bathroom. I was down on my hands and knees, and I was crying out for help. Someone please help me. Someone please help me. And I was getting chills. And he came in the bathroom, and he's like, I'll help you, I'll help you. And I'm like, no, not you, right? Now, my connection to God at that point was, there was no connection to God, right? I still, in my mind, had that Catholic God that was going to have me burn in hell. As a child, I had this vivid dream that felt like every single night, I had this vivid dream of what hell looked like. And you would go down these wide, sort of clay-colored stairs, and there would be chambers on each side of vats of fire and big archways. And as far back as you could look, there were these vats of fire. And there were evil, sinful souls being put into these vats of fire. And I would have that dream as a child, and I would wake up and be terrified. And so my connection with God, there was none, right? God did not want to have anything to do with me. I was a horrible person. Right? I had shamed myself. I had done evil things. I was a drug addict. I was an alcoholic. And so when I got down on that floor at that moment, without me even realizing that there was a power greater than me, was saying, you know, it's time. It's time. And I left there the night, well, I was too hysterical that night. I left there the next morning. And I called St. Mary's in San Francisco, and they had a rehab at the time, inpatient. And I got in there a couple days later. And when I walked through the doors, and they took me to my first group meeting, they showed me to my room. I was going to be there, you know, in this other wing because I had a detox and all that. And I'll never forget walking into that very first meeting, and people started talking about the same stuff that I was doing. And more than that, they started talking about having the same feelings that I had, the despair and the humiliation and the shame that was so pervasive in everything I thought about myself that I just felt this great sigh of relief, and I knew that I had found the right place, that this is where I needed to be and this is where I wanted to be. Up until that point, I had tried to stop drinking a little bit. I had tried to stop smoking crack, sort of. But the moment on Thursday when I was resolute that I was not going to go into the projects and buy crack, I would have a couple beers, and then I would go out. So now I'm in this program, and I'm doing a detox for a few days. And my first or second night there, and I'm in my room and laying in my bed, and I got this overwhelming sense that there was some kind of spirit in the room. And I, you know, maybe I was hallucinating. I don't know. But for me, it was real. And I felt like there was this presence that said, it's going to be okay now. It's going to be okay. And, I mean, I've been blessed, right? I'm 33 years sober, and I've never wanted to look back and drink or use again. Has it all been rosy? And no. It's hard. What we do is really, really hard. It's still hard today for me, even though I've been doing this for a long time and I've stayed connected to AA for a really long time. It's really, really hard. I had to deal with the demons, my thoughts, because like I said, you know, as a kid, all my thoughts were filled with fear. Everything that I thought and everything that happened around me were all negative, and they were all dark. And there was abuse, and, you know, there were beatings, and there never felt like there was any support anywhere in my life. And so I came into the program, and while I still had those thoughts, and it probably, I don't know, not to discourage anyone, 10 years or something, right, where I had to be reminded constantly by my sponsor that my thoughts don't necessarily mean it's reality. And it took me a long time to get there, to realize I wasn't a child anymore and that I didn't have to live that way. You know, I got sober in San Francisco. I met a woman in a meeting. They told me I had to get a sponsor, and I had about 2 weeks sober, and I was still in the program. But in St. Mary's in the auditorium, on Saturday nights, there was actually a Cocaine Anonymous meeting that came in there, and we were required to go downstairs and go to it. And they said, you got to get a sponsor. And there was a woman there who was really loud and laughing and funny and smiling. And so I asked her to be my sponsor when I had 2 weeks sober. She is still my sponsor today. She is an integral part of my entire life. You know, she's been with me through everything that I've experienced. And I don't know what I would do without her. She's getting older, so it's getting scary. But we had fun in San Francisco. You know, we had the Spirit of San Francisco conference was there. We had AA dances. You know, we would go out, we'd go to a meeting, and then we'd go to the meeting after the meeting at a tart-to-tart out in the avenues, and we'd have coffee or tea. And I had no money, by the way, when I got sober, none. And so all these people that I met, these men and women, would buy me dessert. And it was this acceptance and this kind of this embrace and caring that I really didn't feel like I had ever experienced before. And these people were total strangers. And yet the moment that I would step in a meeting, I would be embraced. Today, I'm still that. You know, I go to a meeting somewhere out of town, and I'm still embraced the way that I always have been in the program. Oh, God, I've hardly spoken at all. I just looked at the clock. I'm supposed to speak for a lot longer. Okay. So, you know, some of the things that stand out for me were some of the situations that I put myself in when I was out there using. And like I said, I would go into the projects in San Francisco, and I don't know if any of you have had that experience, but you know, Bayview, Hunters Point, the most dangerous ones probably. One time I thought it'd be a really good idea to go by crack at these ones on Laguna and Turk, and there's catacombs under the buildings. And you know, I'm like 22 years old, and my boyfriend's older, and you know, kind of was a big guy, but I thought it'd be a really good idea that we go there and we try this one situation out. And they're like, well, you can't buy on the street, you have to go in there, and we're gonna take you down in there. And I remember having one cognizant thought at that time, which is, oh my God, we're gonna get murdered. They're gonna steal our money and they're gonna murder us. So I never went back to that project. But I went back to the Sunnydale housing projects, and I went to the Pink Palace, and I knew them well, right? They were like the places that I would go to get what I needed. And to think today that I did those things, and by the way, a bunch of them have been torn down, so it was kind of wild to watch those get torn down. When I had about 18 months sober, my sponsor said, come on, you're coming with me to Salvation Army. And there was a program there called HARP. And it was like a 30-day or 60-day program, and they had Harbor Lights, which was the longer-term living. And I had to go into Harbor Lights, or HARP, and speak. And so I'm telling this story. And mind you, this is the early 90s, right? And this is when crack cocaine was pretty prevalent. And a lot of us were now starting to get sober because we had started in the mid-80s. And I went in there, and it was I spoke and told my story, and then people got to ask questions. And they actually drilled me because they could not believe that me, a little white girl, would go into the projects to buy crack and do the things that I did. And I had to like qualify myself. They asked me, well, what do you call crack cocaine? And so it's hubba. And you know, what does it mean when you get ripped off? Well, it's scaffold, right? So I had to literally like qualify why I was able to go there and speak. That's another thing that's always stuck with me. What I've really appreciated about my sobriety is that all those stories and all those memories that I had when I was a kid that were awful, you know, my dad taking us down into the basement. Oh, our basement flooded once and the water was everywhere. So my brother and I were bucketing the water. Well, we were putting it in the sink. Well, that's the drain that was backed up. So instead of trying to teach us, hey, that's not the way to go, we got beat for doing that, right? Because we didn't know any better. We also, you know, I think too for me, what's formed a lot of mine is that I was a girl, and you know, I was born in 1965, and in the 70s, 60s and 70s, we were supposed to be the ones who helped everyone and were generous to everyone. And I got to take a shower in the shower because we had a bathtub, and I got to take a shower. And the shampoo, I was reading the directions, and it said, put a generous amount in the palm of your hand. And so I put about a dime. Because I wasn't supposed to be generous with myself. I was supposed to be generous with everybody else. And that's another thing that formed like how I grew up and how I thought that I should make sure that everybody has what I don't have first, and then maybe then I can have it. I don't think I'm that codependent today. I don't know, though. My friend Aaron, who's like coda queen back there, might disagree. You know, I'd love to like sit up here and tell you funny stories, but I really don't have any because it wasn't very much fun for me. What's been fun for me is sobriety. Abby, who has been my sponsor for forever, we did everything together. My sponsor, was hanging out with this guy. And she's like, oh, we're just friends. He's a younger guy, but he is a total speed freak. He never sits still. And you should meet him, but she told me I should not go on a date with him. I do not remember that. Not at all. So we meet, we go on a date, we just celebrated 27 years of marriage. So yeah, and I did not 13th step in. He had almost 2 years of sobriety, and I had almost 5. And, you know, it's the relationships that I've developed and have to this day in sobriety have now formed how I think and how I think about myself and how I think about life and how I think about God. I worked the steps, right? I had a sponsor. We did step work. I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of events. I did a lot of service because that's what everybody told me I had to do. You know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, work the steps, be of service, you know, go to events because they're fun. And those are the things that I did all the time. And then I met this guy. Well, okay, wait a minute. Let me back up. I went on a date with this guy. He had 9 months and I had 2 months, and the date lasted 5 years. And he was awful, but I was going to change him. I was going to show him the right way to love someone, because then he'll be able to love me that way. He was a narcissist, as I later figured out. And he would periodically break up with me, and then I'd start dating, and then he'd want me back. And I did that. I did it like 2 times. And the last time he broke up with me, he told me that he always imagined himself with someone taller and thinner. I'm not tall, right? I'm like 5'2". And I've never been really that thin, even on drugs. And that I would never be his intellectual equal. And this is a guy I'd been with for 5 years. I did not get back with him this time. In fact, I jumped on him, and he was 6'4". I jumped on him and shook him and told him that he was really fucked up and that he was really sick and that I was done, right? So we never got back together. But, of course, I met my husband like 3 months later. But the other thing that I used to do, too, when I was out there and doing is I was rather promiscuous. And the moment that I lost my virginity at 16 was the moment that I realized that I could sleep with anybody I wanted. And I did. It was bad. I would get drunk with my girlfriend. We'd go up to the strip where all the students, the college students were. And that's what I did. I thought this was normal, too, by the way. She and I kept a tally. We had a competition going to see who could have the most one-night stands. That was like that was a thing. Like, we had a list, right? I think we were kind of even, Stephen, like 100 and some. That's how bad it was. So I meet Bob. I'm with Bob for 5 years. What I realized, though, the moment that I got sober was that I could no longer not be monogamous. It was fascinating to me. Here I was doing everybody, and I could no longer do that. I had to be monogamous. I was with Bob for 5 years. I've been with Danny for 27. Well, actually more than that, because we actually did date a little while and then got married. And so every aspect of my life changed. You know, every element of who I thought I was and how I thought I should behave and what I thought was normal, the moment I got sober, it all started to change. I did not live in this darkness anymore. I still had fear, and I had to do a lot of work around that. I got outside help early in sobriety because I needed to, because I had been abused as a girl by a family member, and I needed to deal with that. And I needed to do the inner child work that would help repair that. And I did it, and it was amazing. And I know today that I am not a sinner, and I'm not going to burn in hell because of what other people were doing to me. I always did service, too. So I was still terrified when I first got sober. And they needed a coffee maker. To this day, I do not drink coffee. I think it's disgusting. I think it smells really nice. My husband tried to trick me. Oh, no, it's mocha-flavored ice cream. It's got chocolate in it. You won't be able to taste the coffee at all. Yeah, huh? Right. And then, oh, here's a mocha drink. It's chocolate. No, I taste it. But I was like, I'll be the coffee maker. I don't know how, but I'll figure it out. I used to bake. My Polish grandmother, we grew up with her baking. And when I would go to her house, there was comfort there because she would bake all these different things. And so I picked up baking very early in sobriety. And I thought, well, if I bake, then people are going to like me. Because I really wanted you guys to like me. And I didn't know how to break the ice because I could not look you in the eyes yet. When I was out there doing what I was doing, it was very hard for me to look anybody in the eyes. In fact, I usually looked down, because I didn't want anybody to look into my eyes and into my soul and know what a horrible person I was. So I would bake. I would bake fresh carrot cake with cream cheese frosting and fudge brownies and cookies, and it broke the ice for me. So if you're terrified and you're newer, get a commitment and let people talk to you and let them thank you for doing the commitment and thank you for the coffee. And if you don't bake, talk to me, and I'll give you some good recipes. Because it helped. It really did. It was like this icebreaker for me that allowed me to be somebody that I really wanted to be, which was somebody who people actually liked and wanted to be around, because I don't think many people really wanted to be around me very much. And I did that for a long time. I still today, and I'm in Brentwood now. We moved there in 2010. I am known in Brentwood for baking. Because if you go to any meetings that I go to, at one point or another, I have baked something. And if you come to Saturday Night Live in Brentwood, which is the third Saturday of every month as I plug it, I usually bake for that too. Because service is important to me, and it's what's kept the doors of AA open, is people doing service and keeping meetings going and making coffee and showing up and finding speakers for meetings. I don't remember a ton about all the things that I did in early sobriety, but when I hit bottom that day in that man's bathroom, for me it was about the emotional bottom. It was about that despair and the shame and the humiliation. And I just didn't want to do it anymore. I was so tired. And I was so ashamed of who I had become and the things I had done. And if anybody knew of all the things I did, no one would ever love me again. And I didn't want to feel that way anymore. And what people kept saying in the rooms was that you're going to become a different person. You're going to feel differently. You're going to have different emotions. You're going to heal. Just keep coming and keep going to meetings and keep working the steps and keep being of service. And it took time. You know, like I said earlier, it's hard what we do. This is really, really hard. For me, it's a diligence that I've had to keep up all of these 33 plus years. Because if I let my guard down, I'm afraid of what can happen. I go to meetings and I listen to what people say. I listen to people who are my dear friends who keep going out and using and drinking, and then they come back. And when they finally get it and you can see this difference and this light in their eyes, it makes so much difference to everybody in the rooms. And I wanted to be that person. I did not want to go back out there and do what I was doing. I knew that I would die. I always said, I'll be dead by 40. There's no question I'll be dead by 40. I just turned 60, and I'm like, holy crap. I just turned 60, and I'm still sober. Life today for me is, there's a level of ease and comfort in my day that I never imagined I'd have. Even in, like, say, the first 10 years, or maybe even the first 20 years. You know, as I've gotten older, things that I thought were really, really important have become less important. And what matters the most to me is the relationships that I have. I've been in construction. This is actually my 40th year in construction. I started when I was out there drinking and using with my first alcoholic general contractor boss. I ended up going to work for a general contractor in San Francisco, and I worked for them for 25 years. I went to work there when I had about 4 months sober, and I grew up there with that group. And the owner that I grew up with has since retired, and I've since left that company, and we are the dearest friends today because he taught me a lot. And he's normal-ish. He's an amazing guy. But this sense of comfort and ease has come, I think, because of all the work I do, because I listen to all of you, and I listen to stories, and I hear about people's experience, and I watch people in the rooms that have just shifted and changed into these, you know, glowing, healthy people with clear eyes and a calmness about them as well. All the people that I have around me, you know, I have a really amazing group of AA friends in Brentwood. When I got sober in San Francisco, and I still have them, in fact, we celebrated my birthday together, I have 5 very, very close girlfriends in San Francisco. One of our dearest friends passed away in 2016 of COPD, but we all got to be there with her as she took her last breath. But these women mean the world to me. There's 3 women sitting in the back who mean the world to me. I do not know what kind of person I would be if I didn't have the women in my life. Now, I don't know about you, but I did not have girlfriends when I was out there. You would take my men, my alcohol, my drugs, so I didn't want to have anything to do with you. I had no women girlfriends at all when I came into the rooms. On next weekend, I'm going on my 33rd annual women's camping trip. We used to go rafting. Now we're older and decrepit. I have two titanium shoulders now. And, you know, back issues, knee issues, shoulder issues, whatever it is, ankle issues. We go camping now. We don't go rafting anymore. But these women are like the core of my being and who I am today is because I have these amazing friendships with women. I also have some really amazing friendships with men, too. And they're friendships, and that's it. And they are incredible. They're like my brothers. My dad got sober 7 years before he passed away. When I got sober, he had 3.5 years sober. And it was just this world of change. He and my mom stayed together. I don't know how she stayed with him all this time. He was awful. He was mean and angry. And when he got sober and then I got sober, and he lived still back in West Virginia, we would talk every Saturday morning. And he tried AA. He still read the big book, but he chose to go to church and golf. That was like his gods, you know, was Catholic church and golfing. And we would talk every Saturday morning, and we would talk about how our week went with being sober, and he'd ask how my meetings were and what I was up to. And he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And when I had 3.5 years sober, he called me and said, you know, I'm terminal, and it's not going to be much longer. And I got to go back to West Virginia, get him set up in hospice, and help with all that. And I got to be with my dad before he died. And it devastated me when he died. I had no desire to drink, but it devastated me. My heart broke. My dad died. I was not close to my mother. My mother was a cold, cold woman. That's what I thought. She doesn't help me. She ignores me. I fought with her all the time. I have three brothers. So I have an older brother and two younger brothers. And I had more fun playing football in the mud and, you know, street basketball and baseball. And I didn't wear dresses and I wasn't dainty. Yeah, I was like hardcore with the guys. It was way more fun. Oh, my son's calling me. That's hilarious. I've always tried in sobriety to look at where's there a silver lining, right? So my dad passes away. My heart is broken. I don't know what I'm going to do without my dad. My mom and I try for about a year. You know, she comes out to California to visit and everything. And slowly over time, I realized that I was a horrible daughter, and I made my amends, and I have continued today to make a living amends to her. My mom is one of my best friends. We talk every single day. My husband and my mother adore each other because she likes sports, and so does he, and I can't stand watching sports. And they actually call each other and talk about Warriors games and football games and all that, right? It's amazing to me that relationship has happened as well because of sobriety. She's amazing. She goes on trips with us. We're actually going to retire in a couple years. We're moving back to West Virginia. People think we're crazy. We're excited. It's way cheaper to go there. You know, my husband and I started dating. We got married a year and a half later. We both stayed sober. He just had 30 years of sobriety in April. And a few years in, we had a child, a boy, who just turned 24. He is a kid who grew up in AA. He was a newborn, and we were doing the Spirit of San Francisco conference. I don't know if any of you have ever been to that. It was amazing when it was happening. And that my newborn was at that conference because I had signed up for a commitment, and so he went. And he grew up in AA. My son can drink a beer, like one, and be done, right? He tried pot once. He didn't like it. It made him feel weird and paranoid. He doesn't smoke pot anymore, right? We're blown away by this because of who we are and the history and heritage. My husband's Irish, so that tells you a lot. His whole family were alcoholics. They still are, most of them. But, you know, he is just an absolute joy, and he's smart, and we are blessed to have him. He got really, really sick when he was about 9 years old, really, really sick. And there was a moment where I was in San Francisco and I was at work, and I called my sponsor and I said, I can't take this, because that despair had crept in, because how am I going to help my child? Because he was in so much pain and he was so sick. How am I going to help my child? I can't help my child. I don't know what to do. I'm going to go have a drink. She said, I'll meet you at the old St. Mary's. There's a meeting there at 3 o'clock. Leave work early. Meet me there. And I did. I went and met her there. I walked out of there, and I knew I wasn't going to drink over this. I knew that that wasn't going to do me any good, and that wasn't the solution. My son, it took about a year and a half, and he had an autoimmune disease. He's battles with a little bit now, but it took a year and a half. I fought with doctors, too. And remission in a year and a half, and he's fine today. You know, I would like to say that my sobriety's been all fun and there haven't been hardships, but there have been. This is hard, what we do. It's hard to have the same mind that I've had my whole life, and it still creeps in, and I still think the wrong way, and I still have thoughts, and I believe them, and I have to figure out how to not believe them, because most of the time it's all bullshit that I'm making up, and it's not real. And so I have to be diligent, and I have to go to meetings, and I have to work the steps, and I have to call my sponsor, and I have to work with my sponsees. I have sponsees. I've had some in and out, and right now I really have one, and she's amazing. And she's become part of our family. And that's the other thing I've learned here, too, is that I have this huge extended AA family in Brentwood. We have a really good party house. So we have AA parties, pool parties in the summer. We haven't had one this year. I'm slacking. And, you know, we can have 40 people or 50 or 60. And all of them are dear friends of ours, which, holy crap, I had no friends. I had one drug dealer guy, and that was pretty much it. And my cousin who enabled me, because she paid my rent. You know, I have days where I'm exhausted, where I want to just say, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. Like I said, I'm in my 40th year in construction. I now am an owner rep for Sutter Health. I work for Sutter Health, and I work in construction for Sutter Health, and we have a growth strategy, and it's freaking killing me. I come home most days, and I do say, it's sucking the life out of me, and I've been trying to do work around it, and I can't get there yet, but I know I'm going to get there. And because if I don't get there, I'm going to continue to be miserable and feel like the life has been sucked out of me every day. This is the kind of shit I'm talking about, is that I don't care how much time I got like 33 years, right? And I still have to do the work around those kinds of thoughts, where I am blessed. I have an amazing job. I get paid well. I get really good benefits. I have the material things. I have a beautiful home. I'm going to retire, hopefully, in 10 months. Let's cross our fingers. And, you know, and so I have all these things that everybody maybe might look at it and go, wow, they've got, you know, Kathleen and Danny got it going on, right? They're just, that's amazing. But I'm still who I am, and I'm still a drug addict, and I'm still an alcoholic. And I know that if I don't pay attention, that one little day, I could go and I could pick up some tequila and do a bunch of shots, right? I know for sure I could do those things. So it's really great to be here. I am sweating profusely. which I'm sure everyone is. Again, I'm really honored. Thank you, Jag, for hosting. And it's really wonderful to see all of you. Thank you.